Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Friday, April 22nd, 2022. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program where I will be interviewing contributors to the Barnes Review History Magazine, a bi-monthly print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts. Today, I am joined by Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, a regular contributor to the Barnes Review, and host of the Orthodox Nationalist podcast program. All right, Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, welcome to the program, sir. How are you today?
Hey, my friend, it's been way too long since we've spoken. I also did want to say something about Ed DeVries, who was the Barnes Review host. We got COVID at the same time. Unfortunately, it went two different ways. I recovered after a month. He, unfortunately, didn't. And he's definitely missed.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Well said. I completely agree. He passed away a few months ago, if I'm not mistaken, and he was a major contributor to the Barnes Review, hosted the TBR History Hour, and was a great writer and preacher and pastor, and I know he was very, very active. I think he was at somewhere down in the South, and I know he was very active politically and involved in the church and the community, so he is definitely surely missed. But as you said, yeah, there's a lot going on in the world today, especially as it relates to your academic specialty, which is, of course, Russian Orthodox political tradition and history. And you are a regular contributor to the Barnes Review History Magazine, a magazine which, of course, I highly recommend all of our listeners subscribe to. And you can find out all the details at barnesreview.com. And just a bit of your background, you received your doctorate in the history of political philosophy from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, the same university system that I received my undergraduate degree from, which the University of Nebraska may not be too happy with us advertising that, but it is true. And you also host your own podcast program called The Orthodox Nationalist, which I listen to regularly. That airs on Radio Albion. And you also appear as a guest on a number of other podcasts and radio programs, including The Daily Nationalist, which is hosted by Sven Longshanks and is also broadcast on Radio Albion. And you have a website featuring many of your longer articles called RusJournal.org. And I will have a link over to, I know you also just recently set up a website for the Orthodox Nationalist, correct?
Yeah, actually, Sven Longshanks did it. It's theorthodoxnationalist.wordpress.com.
Okay, and very good. Yeah, I'll have a link to it once this podcast goes up. Yep. Yeah,
so you can donate to me. Mm-hmm. That's the important thing is my books are for sale there, all my donations, because this is what I do full time. I have a Bitcoin wallet, and that WordPress page has everything on there.
Okay, yeah, very good. Yeah, definitely. I'll have it linked when I post this podcast program. And so I guess, needless to say, you are very busy these days with all this with this conflict going on in Ukraine and, you know, sort of the bigger geopolitical issues at play now. And to get started, I'd actually like to get your take on this very long history of Western treachery directed towards Russia. You know, obviously this is a topic you've written and spoken about extensively. So I'm just curious, can you maybe give us just a brief overview or like a general assessment of this deep-rooted hostility towards Russia by Western nations such as the United Kingdom, for example, and now obviously the United States? What has traditionally driven this hostility towards Russia in your view?
Well, I think there's been many, many centuries ago it was religion. Especially with Roman Catholic countries like France. But it began in earnest in the reign of Tsar Nicholas I with Crimea, where the Russian Empire fought the entire Western world, with the exception of Austria-Hungary. And that continued with Japan, who was essentially with Britain, in the early part of the 20th century. Now, Great Britain has, despite their being, you know, sort of on the same side in World War One, Great Britain has been the enemy of Russia for centuries. All of the propaganda about them being Asiatic or backwards or sort of not European or violent and dark and all that stuff, that came from the British press, of which, by the way, Karl Marx and Frederick Engels were contributing members during the Crimean War. I mean, you listen to read Karl Marx at the time, he's like a neocon. You know, how anything that harms the British war effort has to be condemned, despite the unpopularity of that war in Britain. The same thing for Japan. But because this is really a kind of a black spot, certainly with our people and even academics, the regime can say what it pleases. These weren't losses for Russia, although they paid dearly for it, despite the fact that the entire world was at war with them. Great Britain's an enemy, the Russian Empire, because of their economic competition. Ideology is a huge, they're complete night and day, ideologically speaking. But whether it be in the Far East or Central Asia, coming close to India under Emperor Paul, and the Turkish, former Turkish Empire, which means the Black Sea and then the Mediterranean, Russia has always been their primary opponent. In the 19th century, Russia exploded after the disastrous 18th century. 19th century, Russia very quickly, like Germany, became one of the world's leading not only industrial powers, agricultural powers, but also when oil was discovered in Baku, with today Azerbaijan, the British went crazy and took it over, by the way, during the Russian Civil War. So they're always – and Russia's enemies tend to be created and financed and organized by Britain. And one of the worst problems that Britain had at the end of the 19th century was the Turkish Empire falling apart. Russia destroyed it, you know, defeated it in battle after battle. And if the Turkish Empire falls apart, that means Russian interests will be able to penetrate the Middle East, North Africa, and their Slavic allies in the Balkans. You're talking about gigantic areas of sea and land, huge resources, big markets. So that means that the British and to a lesser extent the French artificially propped up the Turkish Empire and then somehow supported the Turkish colonial empire in southern Europe. The Slavs were under Turkish control as a colonial subject for, you know, a couple of centuries, you know, Serbia, Bulgaria, et cetera, Greece. So because the British, you know, Rothschild Bank, of course, is a private entity, and the Russian Empire's bank was state-controlled, actually controlled by the monarch himself. This meant that even at that level, the British could not crack the Russian market, which, of course, was enormous and growing in wealth. And now, because Germany and Russia were coming up around the same time and seemed to be natural allies, Britain certainly couldn't handle both at the same time. So they had to figure a way. I mean, the only chance they had was to get them to fight one another. And they found the missing, the weak link in all, with Austria and the Balkans, and that's what they promoted. And that's
which is,
how they
which
maintained
is what
supremacy.
Led, of course, to World War One.
Yeah.
Yep. And then, yeah, no, that's very, very interesting. And this is a big topic and one that obviously comes into play with this current situation in Ukraine. I've actually been reading a bit about the world island theory put forth by Halford John Mackinder, who was a British, I don't know exactly what he was, if he, some sort of scientist, or he was a geologist, I think, wasn't he? And he wrote the Geographical Pivot of History article back in the early 1900s, which basically sort of formed the basis of British foreign policy and their desire to control Central Asia. And they, you know, they call it the world island, which basically consisted of Europe, Asia, and Africa, essentially. Do I have that right? I know you clearly know much more about this than I do, but I find it very fascinating. And I think it's a key part of understanding the history of this region and certainly, you know, with what's going on today.
Well, you know, I just did a lecture about it. I think it was 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, something like that, on Radio Albion, and I have a paper out on it. Of course, I had to read him in grad school, but I kind of forgot about him. And then I began reading Dugin in the original, and then, oh, because Dugin is very much into that theory. To put it as simply as possible, what we call the steppe, this very hard-to-control area in the southern Russian, it affects, you know, Central Asia, this huge, relatively flat piece of land because it connects three continents, that really is everyone's drive. You can control that. You can control the borders of pretty much everywhere. It's not an accident that the Russo-Chinese Belt and Road Initiative is unifying this area. Dugin goes so far as to say that this was driving Soviet foreign policy to bring all of Central Asia into the Soviet Union. He has a much more positive view of the Soviet Union than I do, which is one big disagreement. But yeah, you're essentially correct. This is where the resources, this is not so much in and of itself something that people want, but it is an access point for everything else. This region is connecting three continents, and today, of course, gigantic markets. This is what Britain, France, Russia, Japan, and even China have been fighting over for centuries. This is way beyond the capacity of the mass man in the Western world to comprehend. They need, you know, action movies. You know, the difference between foreign policy reporting and the action Rambo-style movie is almost non-existent. They need simple narrative. They need simple white hat, black hat kind of story. And the press is aware of it. And so they simply invent whatever they have to. The problem of being a specialist in this area is that we realize that they don't know anything about it. No one really does. No elite really does. So they pretty much say whatever they want, knowing full well that there are very few people that are going to be able to contradict them. And, of course,
right. Johnson's Law.
That was yeah. I named that after myself with Michael Collins Piper, and we did the article on Burma. And I began realizing that in terms of the Burmese, the heroin trade and everything, they were simply inventing stories. They invented an entire ethnic group of people, the Rohingya, that nonsense. That's a slang term. You know, they simply don't know, but it doesn't matter because they can pretty much do whatever they please and no one's going to contradict them because no one either wants to or has the capacity to.
Very interesting. Well, I think this sort of world island thesis makes a lot of sense. And I think it, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't this saying something like whoever controls this key piece of geography really controls the world, and whoever controls Eastern Europe will ultimately control this part of the world, which is why, you know, NATO has been so eager to sort of undermine Russia, you know, in Eastern Europe following the collapse of the Soviet Union.
You know, I've said it 100 times, but this kind of saber rattling, this kind of obsession with violence, including nuclear weapons, that's coming from Washington and Brussels and NATO in general, was never, ever the case during the so-called Cold War. There was never any sanctions on the Soviet Union. Soviet military men and elites were being educated in the U.S. That's when all of the arms limitation talks came into existence. And today, those have all been nullified. The Trump administration, Obama, Bush, they've pulled out of every treaty that they ever really were associated with, which is why no one trusts them. So once Russia was taken over by a more or less nationalist and Eurasianist group of people led by Vladimir Putin, nationalism is really the only consistent enemy of the liberal empire. Communism was never a problem. Communism only became a problem when it got too big. But that would be the case for anybody. That's not an ideological thing. It's a practical thing. But you have nationalists all over the world now. You have it in China. You have it in Russia. You have it in Belarus. Now even Hungary. That's been the case. Even Poland for a long time. There's a lot of panicking going on in Washington. And the fact is these countries are doing much better economically in pretty much every other way than the West is. The West is disintegrating economically speaking, not to mention racially and civically speaking.
Right. Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think that explains the hysteria we see in D.C., in Brussels. They realize that this American-led world order is quickly disintegrating. And, you know, Russia and China and the BRICS nations are standing up to offer a very legitimate and probably much more responsible ordering of the world. And I think that scares them to death.
No, the fact that they have to rely on these mythical sanctions. Now I have a whole paper, a lengthy paper, on what sanctions really are and the legal foundation in the U.S. You know, we were told even under the Obama administration that Russia has been sanctioned, their financial institutions. But every year, the same ruling class keeps saying, well, now we're going to add more sanctions to this. And, you know, when you read the laws, this is the case for Iran as well as Russia, they have to be very specific about what they sanction. They have to mention a company and put the address and a reason why. And individuals, the same thing. Presidents can nullify sanctions anytime he wants. That's actually written into the law, too. There's plenty of American firms operating in Iran and in Russia that aren't going anywhere. In fact, to this day, the major Russian banks were either state-owned or semi-state-owned, like Gazprom Bank, are not subject to sanctions. Russia doesn't really need the U.S. Russia's aim had always been to unify this area that we're talking about, which would include access to India and China. You may have read recently that the Indians have given the finger to the U.S. They are not only maintaining the relationship with Russia, but they're increasing it, both military and economic, energy related. They're building new pipelines. And the Indians, you have a group of people who've been under colonial British control for a long time. It's really not a good idea to come marching in there and telling them what to do. So now they've alienated the number one and number two most populated countries on the planet and the number one world economy, which is China. They're not going to win this.
Right. Oh, yeah. No, I completely agree. And it's frankly, it's a very welcoming development, in my opinion, anyways, considering how evil this American-led world order has been for so long. I want to kind of go back and talk very briefly about you actually had the lead article in the most recent edition of the Barnes Review, the March-April 2022 edition. And it's really an overview of the Russo-Japanese War, which took place in the early 1900s prior to World War I. And it's sort of generally been portrayed as this like devastating defeat for the Russian Empire, you know, a precursor to the destruction of the Russian monarchy and, you know, the bloody revolution, which was brewing in Russia at the time, you know, sort of culminating in the Bolshevik takeover. But I'm just curious, what is your assessment of this conflict? I mean, you know, reading this article, it made pretty clear that not only this historic Western treachery towards Russia, but also the role the media played in demonizing Russia and creating these myths, right? I mean, I think that's a central part of this. And it you know, it was very clear in reading your article. And again, you know, we certainly see that today with all this atrocity propaganda we see in the West towards Russia.
And it's all the same. Whether you talk about the Crimean War, then a generation or two later in the Far East, or this war in Ukraine, the rhetoric is exactly the same. And it's, number one, that Russia is backwards and ignorant. Number two, that they're going to lose and fall apart at any moment. Number three, that, oh, they're winning. I mean, sorry, their enemies are winning on every front. They have no chance. And, you know, as Johnson's Law would say, what the heck do these guys know? The media is not there to tell you the truth. The media is there to tell a good story to keep you interested. That's their job. If the truth was at root, then it would be, you know, historians doing it. But because the Russo-Japanese War is such a huge blank spot, the truth is every book in English or article in English I've ever read concerning the Japanese War uses the phrase, some version of the phrase, humiliating defeat. And for those very same reasons. I guess it's just laziness at this point. The fact is that the only reason that Russia had to pull out was the revolution at home, which was being, by the way, organized by the same people who were financing the Japanese. Japanese were exhausted. There were riots in Tokyo, just like there were in London. The commander of the ground forces at the Port Arthur, which was a defeat, more or less, for Japan, killed himself, begged the emperor to commit suicide in front of him because of the disaster. Port Arthur is supposed to be this defeat, and yet the Japanese couldn't take it. After five attacks, they lost huge amounts of men. The commander of the Russian fort had every intention. He was doing fine. Everyone underestimated what Russia was capable of doing. Now, this is 5,000 miles from Moscow. But the Trans-Siberian Railroad had been completed, and you had 17 to 20 full trains a day financing the forces there. Japan had almost a million men in this theater. These were some huge fronts like Mukden and the battles on the Chinese mainland had these, you know, 120-mile fronts. Japan was broke. Japan was exhausted. They issued a draft that even guys in their 50s had to report for duty. They were going from 15 to almost 60 because they were running out of men. Japan was using about 110% of their ability with a navy that was established both by the U.S. and Britain and given to them. And the whole thing, Japan did what they did because the British were telling them to do that. And everyone thought that Russia couldn't get enough people out there on time. And if Port Arthur is completed, it was not completed at the time, then Russia will be able to dominate the sea there. But the Pacific was seen as a secondary theater. Russian and Japanese losses were about the same, despite the fact that Russia has a much, much larger population. It didn't really affect the Russian economy. Just like today in Ukraine, Russia's using, what, 5, 10% of its ability. Japan was absolutely at the breaking point, and I actually wrote this in my first book too. Even, you know, the Russians were, whenever they did retreat, of course this is far out of their area, they were supporting the Chinese, the British were supporting the Japanese. Unfortunately, China was falling apart at the time. The Russian army in Manchuria was about 400,000 men, and then eventually it came to almost 800,000. But these were draws. None of the goals that Japan had in this war were ever met. That's the key issue. They fought Japan to a draw, and where Japan was starting to do very poorly because they were simply exhausted. Their losses were about the same, but Japan couldn't fight on for another month. So the British had another attack, and that was to create the violence in near Moscow and St. Petersburg. And that's what drew the Russians out of there. Otherwise, Japan would have been almost a colony of Russia by that point.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. So, is it fair to say that this Russo-Japanese war was basically sort of like a proxy war, right? I mean, the British were essentially funding and sort of instigating the Japanese into this conflict, much like we see the Western powers using Ukraine in a proxy war against Russia today. Do you see a parallel there?
Yeah, of course. You know, Britain is pretty tiny. They had to function through their scientific establishment, through the banking establishment, and knowing how to split their enemy. And again, that's where World War I came from. The Japanese and the Russians were working out their differences over China. But all of a sudden, before the shooting started, all of a sudden the Japanese start getting very aggressive, not agreeing to anything, not showing up, that kind of thing. And what was happening was the British were pushing them to this. They obviously don't have the men or the ships to fight, you know, four wars at once. They mobilized the Turkish tribes in the southern Russian border. They were mobilizing, of course, Turkey in the western part, and of course Japan in the Far East. Britain was despised in China over the opium issue, humiliated. They ransacked the Chinese capital solely so that the Sassoon family could have their have more addicts in China. China destroyed their drug, fought a drug war for 6 months and eradicated it. So they're always using. You know, Ukraine is such a shame because it's a huge country that has, as I've said before, the best educated population in the world. That is, a larger proportion of their population has advanced degrees than any other country on the planet. And now they're a fourth world backwater. They were fourth world before this war. And now with nothing, an economy based entirely on foreign aid, like Albania, just without all the drug addiction. Ukraine doesn't have much to offer the West, but they do have much to offer the East. That's where their economy came from, being a part of the Eurasian economy, the Western economy. You know, so it's just a battering ram at this point. Japan was more effective. Ukraine was never a major military power. And everything that they've ever had has been destroyed now. And a handful of mercenaries are holding out in a few places.
Right.
But just like in Japan, it's only a small percentage of their military power is being deployed at all.
Yeah, some of the videos and images I've seen coming out of, especially eastern Ukraine, I mean, Mariupol is just totally destroyed. And all for what? I mean, what is the point of all this? I mean, it's really just, you know, clearly misguided policy, not only in the West but also Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine is being manipulated, and they're playing right along in this endeavor. It's really very, very tragic and unnecessary. But you know, that's what happens when I think really what this boils down to is we saw in the 20th century, I mean the 20th century itself was really defined by this sort of Jewish-inspired desire to overthrow and destroy their traditional monarchs in Europe, you know, destruction of the sense of national identity and pride in white Western nations. And I think another key pillar, a subversion and removal of Christianity as a central organizing force in society. And, you know, of course, World War II sort of represented the total victory of this subversive evil force over the forces of nationalism and patriotism and Christianity. And Russia is really kind of standing up to this, right? I mean, with Putin, at least that's my assessment, is they're sort of moving away from this and standing up for their country and trying to do what's right. And you know, so it's clearly, again, a battle between the forces of globalism and nationalism represented in Russia.
Well,
Do you
I was at
agree
the
with that
Barnes Review.
assessment? Yeah.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, that's my whole career is based on this these days. I was at the Barnes Review in 2001, early 2002, and I was the only person on our side for the nationalist movement, you know, whatever you want to call it, who understood what Putin was. And I was attacked by everybody. And I mean everybody, including some of the biggest promoters of him now, attacked me back then. Oh, he's KGB. What's the matter with you? But I convinced Willis Cardo and Michael Collins Piper that this man, that I had a front page article on him back then, and then they converted everyone else, and before you know it, Putin is the more or less champion of the right, not the left, like the regime thought he was in the beginning. So this, you know, the Putin stuff is you could it's all on my door. So if you don't like this stuff, it's entirely my fault.
Yeah. Well,
And it
you
was.
did. You wrote Putin, Russian Populist, right? I mean, when was that published? In
2012.
2000. I was going to say 2011, 2012. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was made, well, it was written for many years before then, but the Barnes Review Archives, as well as my website at the time, the American Journal of Russian and Slavic Studies, has some of the material that that book relied on. That goes back, I think the first major thing was the Barnes Review, was 2002, I think. From there, that became, because, you know, Russia was my thing anyway. And, you know, people were so hung up on the KGB stuff. Remember, the era is 20 years ago. The era, you know, there were still the anti-communists around. And I was trying to explain what that means, where it comes from, what Russia was, the Soviet Union was in the 1970s, and where he came up. And after a while, it finally dawned on them that this really is someone, and really the only person, that, of course, now China and India, Iran, you know, all mostly first world countries, certainly Iran and China are, that is the only break on liberal globalization in the world. Russia, because it's an Orthodox power, now Orthodoxy is one of the official religions of the Russian Federation, and the Patriarch is right in the Kremlin, where he always has been in the past. You know, I did show after show on the constitutional amendments in Russia, condemning homosexuality, the family. They are financing Russian families having children, as they're doing the same thing in Belarus. Tax breaks. You know, 25% for a child, depending on where you are. Huge subsidies, like you had in Libya under Gaddafi. Young families get a huge influx of money from the state. And because of the success of the Russian economy, they have no debt. They are in control of a huge amount of gold. The U.S. has zero. And the market in India and in China, it doesn't matter. Russia has so much gold, they can have zero economic activity for the next 5 years and have it not affect them at all. That's what's backing, you know, the ruble is backed by not just gold, but oil and natural resource, which is, I'm pretty sure, the first time that's ever happened. And the banks are all now state-owned, and they are a part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. The only one talking about that is the alliance of countries that fit this world, not the world island, but the heartland, as Mackinder would call it. All of Central Asia, India, even Pakistan, China, a lot of Southeast Asia, and Russia. Russia and China were the ones who founded it. This is not only an economic alliance, but a military alliance that has most of the world's population in it. And when Turkey applied for membership, and not only that, asked for to retool their military apparatus with Russian, the S-400 and the missile defense, the West went, this is some of the things that were, I mean, talk about panic. And you're looking at mass inflation, mass unemployment, which, you know, unemployment is much higher than is being reported. This war, as I predicted it, I wasn't sure it was going to be over Ukraine or what, but the war, either with Russia or China, I predicted, because that's the last arrow in their quiver.
Right. Oh yeah, no, I tend to agree with you. And I tended to agree with you even before this war started. I've always tried to keep an open mind on all subjects, really, but I tended to agree with your assessment of Putin. And really, leading up to the conflict, I was following it very closely, and I've tried to listen to every speech Putin has given. I've read the Russian Ministry of Defense and Foreign Ministry, some of their statements. Russia's foreign minister Lavrov. I've listened to some of his interviews, and it is just very, very clear that the Russian political establishment, represented by Putin and Lavrov and some of these other guys, are very, responsible, composed, honorable, honest. I mean, there's a very stark difference between the Russian political leadership and what we see in the West, and that has been very, very vividly on display as a result of this conflict. And only sort of, I think, strengthens this argument that Putin is this populist. I don't think he, and this is where there's some controversy, right? Because he's really not a traditional white nationalist that you would think of in the West, right? I mean, he's more of a Russian populist. I've heard him describe Russians as like state forming or state building peoples. So clearly, he sees Russians as a very like unique group of people worth preserving and protecting, right? I mean, I think that's pretty clear based on some of his statements and policies.
My God, the very fact that we have to congratulate that, I mean, that's the number one basic point of the state in the first place.
Exactly,
White nationalist, you can't be that in Russia. You have all kinds of non-whites in the South, many of whom are extremely loyal, and the Crimeans themselves. That's not an issue, because the white nations have been his enemies. So he's going to be very careful. But I do have, as you mentioned, the book Russian Populist, A Political Thought of Vladimir Putin, published by the Barnes Review, that gets it into exactly what he is politically and what motivates him in terms of philosophy and ideology. And he is a Eurasianist. He believes in national independence. And the difference is that in the East, Russia, China, Iran, the state is more powerful than capital. And when Putin was reconstructing the Russian economy, the state had to come first. The police agencies, the army, tax collection, which had collapsed to zero, that had to come first. And after that was done, then the other aspects of the economy simply took off on their own, because now they had confidence in something. So that always means that, again, given Putin's ridiculous levels of popularity, but he's about 80% right now, he calls the shots. Now, in the West, capital, the billionaires, BlackRock especially, they tell politicians what to do, where, of course, in Russia, it's the exact opposite. And that's why these guys don't have to be duplicitous for the most part, because they run their own show. They have their own sources of financing. It was like Donald Trump's first campaign, totally self-financed, which the regime was going bonkers over that. I mean, Trump did go to AIPAC and said, "I don't need your money," if you remember. And that's
Oh
what
yeah.
happens.
Yep.
That's what happens when you're not funded by outside sources. I've always said, and in my book on Putin, I do make the charge that there is a psychological element here. The Western political class is extremely unpopular. They're totally out of touch. And they don't have much power. Capital, BlackRock, Vanguard Investments, they have the power. Rothschild, whoever you want to talk about. It's all really the same people. So they have no power and they have no popularity. Anything goes wrong, they don't blame the banks, who are at fault. They blame politicians. So they're projecting a lot of that, what they really want, the desires that they have to be popular and to be in charge of things, onto Putin. It is a psychological element. The self-hatred is they blame Russia for things that they do every day. And there's got to be a thing, they construct in their minds what Russia or Putin might be. They invent it. They need this enemy. And it is the result of their deep-seated frustrations that it is their donors, it is capital, it are the banks that tell them what to do. Putin does not have that. And as a result, Putin is extremely popular. But of course, pretty much no one in the U.S. It's a handful. But generally, the political class as a whole is, unpopular in Russia. Poll after poll, every year, the two people that Russians have confidence in are the patriarch and the president. Every year. And American politicians would kill to have that. And so they have to wipe it out.
Right. Yeah, well, and from what I understand, Putin's popularity has only increased as a result of this conflict. And I'm curious, I'd like to maybe for you to comment on his relationship over the years with these oligarchs that sort of took over the Russian economy following the collapse of the Soviet Union. There was actually a really good article that I can only actually find on nationalvanguard.org. I'm not sure where this was originally published. But it was written back in May of 2012 by a man named Justin Cowgill. It's called The Silent Coup, Putin versus the Oligarchs. And it's a very, very interesting read. And it outlines Putin's relationship with some of these oligarchs that came to dominate the Russian economy and how he really checked them once he came into power. And many of them fled Russia. Some of them stayed, but they were really, they weren't, they were basically under control, right? I mean, for lack of a better term, they were not allowed to run roughshod over the Russian economy and exploit it the way that they had prior to Putin coming into power. So I'm curious. I know you've done some other interviews talking about this subject. I'm curious. Could you give us a just a brief overview of Putin's relationship with these oligarchs?
Well, of course, as I say, I was the first one. These other guys, I don't know specifically, but so many of these other guys, Nathaniel, these people, they took from me. I was the first one making these arguments because I was teaching myself Russian, at least for reading, basic stuff. And I was the first one. I had this on my site. I had it in the Barnes Review. I had it in American Free Press. I had it all over the place on interviews. I was at the Voice of Reason starting in 2007 or something like that. And this was my big argument. And I mentioned before how Putin had to recreate the state. That was before the economy could function at all. The state has to be there. This is part of the problem in the 1990s. With American assistance, Harvard University especially, their Institute for Transitional Economies, which was shut down, they created an oligarchic class, and almost exclusively Jewish, with Potanin back then, I think was the only non-Jew. They had names like Feinberg, blatantly. And they became some of the richest men in the world by dissolving these with profitable companies that remained, the work of 100 years of Russian and other Slavic peoples. And they were despised. Putin was initially, and Yeltsin, of course, didn't function. He's like Joe Biden in this sense. He didn't have any power, didn't know where he was most of the time, and that was perfect. These are perfect frontmen, far more powerful people. Even the guys in the state government that created this, Chubais and Gaidar, all Jews. This is not a coincidence. And the people in the U.S., Schlieffer and so many also. So there's a clear ethnic connection here. You can't deny it. It can't be a coincidence. But they initially had financed Putin after Yeltsin clearly was irrelevant. And he took their money and he shoved it in their face. And he said, guess what's going to happen now? He had his own sort of, he had a military background. He had a police background. He was fine. He didn't need them. And then he began, once he rebuilt the tax collecting apparatus, the current prime minister, by the way, is a big part of that, he started filing suit. He was realizing, when Khodorkovsky was arrested, taken out of his limousine, he was on his way to a meeting where he was going to give over a lot of Russia's Far Eastern oil fields to ExxonMobil. That's why he had to be stopped before he did that. After then, so many others, Guzinski, some of the early oligarchs, media controllers, had to flee the country. He was taking them for huge back taxes, and he was correct. These were not only, oligarchs, they were mafia figures in a way. Remember, the Russian, so-called Russian mafia is the Jewish mafia. They're entirely, exclusively Jewish. I also put that in a Barnes Review many years ago. So that was the foundation of his popularity. Had he taken these guys in Red Square and hanged them, he would have been even more popular. But on the other hand, because they took so many billions out of Russia and kept it in New York City, Geneva, and San Francisco, he had to be careful. He couldn't completely alienate them. Because you still had a lot, and he's recovered a lot of this. So much money had been shipped abroad. Today, you are not allowed to ship any currency abroad. So it has to stay in Russia. And people, these guys got arrested for that. And the U.S. and Jewish media was screaming anti-Semitism, fascism, and they called them a fascist and a communist, sometimes in the same sentence, which always made me laugh. Typical American media, this hyper-emotional, incapable of stringing two thoughts together. But the more he did it, the more popular he became. You had a moderate period under Medvedev, but then rebuilding the church at the same time, rebuilding the family at the same time. There's still so much work to be done. But there's only so much that the state can do. But
so once
to be connected with the state to operate, just like in China.
Okay, right. Yeah, no, that makes sense. So basically, once he got control of the state, he basically used it to rein these guys in.
Yeah, and the more he did it, you know, I'm always reminded of South Korea. The greatest Asian leader in the 20th century is General Chung-hee Park. He took over after Syngman Rhee. He rebuilt South Korea from a fifth world backwater to a first world economy in 10 years, 10 years at the most. And the way he did it is, I mean, he read Hitler stuff, he read Bismarck stuff, he read Napoleon stuff. And that's why the U.S. actually sided with North Korea for a while. That's a long story. But he took the economic elites in Korea and threw them in prison because he wanted them to. And he said, here, I'm going to make you a deal. If you don't want to cooperate with me in reconstructing this country on a populist basis, you can stay here and you're not going to get out. Those who do want to follow me can come out. I'll give you free reign. And you guys who don't want to cooperate with me, you'll be rotten in prison while your rivals are having a great time out here. He then took over he created the yuan, which is the state-controlled currency, hid it from the Americans until the very day it was introduced, and completely – very, very similar concept. I wish Putin would have gone farther like General Park did. But how do you – that's how you take a fourth world to a first world economy in a short period of time. We know a few other people who have done this, but they're very, very few, and Putin is one of them.
And Putin he came into power what in 1999 or 2000?
Yeah, New Year's Eve 99 2000. Right.
And at that point, I mean, Russia was in shambles. I mean, alcoholism was rampant. The economy was basically controlled by this clique of Jews, as you outlined.
Yeah.
And so yeah, he's really made a lot of progress, to say the very least. Well, I'm curious, and again, you know, he's been very, very popular this entire time, including especially now after this special military operation, which is how the Russians describe what's going on in Ukraine. And I'm curious, what is your take on the Russian military operation in general? From what I've read, it looks like it looks like Mariupol is essentially under Russian control at this point, which is a huge, you know, sort of stronghold of the Ukrainian armed forces and some of these other private militias. So I'm curious, what's your assessment of their overall strategy since they launched this special military operation in late February?
Yeah, we know that the militias in the east, Donetsk and the New Russia, had defeated the Ukrainian army. Most of them, or a good portion of them, deserted. Desertion is a huge problem. They're very careful, and I think too careful, in terms of minimizing civilian casualties. They could have took the country in a week if they wanted to, but they moved slowly. It's like General Franco's strategy in the Spanish Civil War. It reminds me of that. Very slow, very conservative. He knew that he had support all over the place. My God, I mean, in 2015, you had 5,000 Ukrainians applying for Russian visas every day. But of course, desertion has been a huge problem, especially when the equipment doesn't match. You know, you have American, you have British, you have Soviet, having to work together. But within a week, the central command of the Ukrainian armed forces had dissolved. Most of its air force, such as it was destroyed on the ground. They wouldn't dare face the Russian air force head to head. The depots that the West had given them were destroyed very quickly. They knew where it was. These precision missile strikes, the hypersonic, which the West does not have, missile system that Russia has, and most importantly, their fuel depots were destroyed. They were out of fuel in 10 days. Now, you notice with all of this, the Western media said the exact thing is happening to the Russians, which didn't make any sense. What really matters here is these militias trained by others being sneaked into Ukraine. It was very hard to do, even to the point where the president, which is just a appointee of the U.S., says no more. We can't be using these guys anymore. They were very unpopular groups. You know, these guys tried to run for election a few years ago. I think they got 0.5%, 0.7% at the most. And even with Western financing, which is typical over there. But all grand total, they had about 7,000 men. But they knew what guerrilla tactics were. And their numbers don't matter. But what they did is they hid in buildings. They brought heavy weapons into a residential area. And, you know, knowing full well that Russia's not going to do much about it. The funny thing about Mariupol, of course, it's a Russian-speaking area. It's still in Donetsk, the Donetsk area. They're pro-Putin there. And these, you know, because they're not under any rules of war, they're like the Viet Cong. They'll use human ships and using human shields since the day this started. But as far as Ukrainian regulars are concerned, that dissolved. The Ukrainian regulars now, because there is no central command, are taking on the coloring of a militia. Because there is no, you know, orders are not being given because there's no chain of command anymore. The communications, one of the first things that the Russians did, and I love this, is that they knocked out all the TV stations and all the radio outlets, knowing full well that they have been pushing anti-Russian propaganda since the day they were created with Western money. But again, desertion was out of control, and you already had an economy that was a disaster. They simply had no money to continue this. And so the press, knowing full well that no one knew anything, was inventing things, inventing stories about poison gas, and you know, off the top of their heads, knowing full well it wasn't true, and so knocking out the media centers in Ukraine, which was created by the state. Remember, Russian media was banned. You had broadcasters killed all the time by the state. People don't realize what had happened after 2014, 2015. In 2014, from January to February 2014, 5,000 people were executed in Kiev. 10,000 were killed immediately after the coup, and another 5,000 in March. Fresh water supply to Crimea. This is what they were, and this is why the media had to be destroyed, because that's what was being promoted at the time.
Right, and in this, yeah, what you're describing has been totally left out of any coverage of this conflict. What happened after this Maidan coup, and this is really what led to this conflict. If I'm not mistaken, I mean, the people in the Donbass region, the people in Crimea, they saw this Maidan coup as essentially what it was—a Western-backed coup to prop up an illegitimate regime that was extremely anti-Russian, and they wanted nothing to do with the government. Right? I mean, that's what this. What sparked this conflict to begin with back in 2014?
Yeah, using what we mentioned before, using Ukraine as like Japan was or even Turkey was centuries ago, using them as a battering ram. The economy from 14 to COVID was on the constant precipice of collapse. You got mass unemployment. Most of the economy is, in fact, black market. Because the fact is that the profitable in industry and even the natural resources like coal are all based in the East. You had oil transit reduced to 25% of what it was in the early 90s. Prices were going through the roof. Hospitals were being shut down. You didn't have the manpower or the money to keep the nuclear reactors going, which is why this talk about a nuclear reactor, they weren't functional. They were used as barracks. Inflation is ridiculous. Talk about 25% decay or reduction of economic production just in the first year. It's like going back to the 90s again. These people are not going to be supporting the Western regime or the European Union or NATO or anything like that. And Yanukovych, I also did an article on his political thought, which no one's done. He was all right, kind of a Soviet bureaucrat, but he had strong patriotic aspects of his persona.
Now he was the president overthrown in 2014, correct?
That's right.
Right. Okay. Yeah. No, it's a very complex situation. And again, I mean, you won't hear any of these details in the Western media. It's just simply boiled down to Putin and Russia are these evil monsters that are committing war crimes and other atrocities. They're trying to oppress the Ukrainian people. I mean, none of this is even covered at all in the West. And again, if you look at some of the speeches that Putin has made, laying out his reasoning and justification for launching this special military operation, this is one of the main things he points to. that I mean they repeatedly cite, I think it's 15,000 people, 15,000 mostly civilians who have died in the Donbass region since 2014. I mean, this yes. has been a tragedy that nobody even knows about.
No, I was the first to translate the Declaration of Independence and their early political writings from a new Russia or Eastern Ukraine. And there are people. They talk about usury. They talk about individualism. They talk about Western capitalism. They talk about liberalism as the enemy. It was incredible. And I got, noticed for that. No one even knew where these places were. These are all our people over there. But let me give you an example. The issue of the Ukrainian finance minister, and I say that with a roll of my eyes, came up in the news yesterday. And I remember some of these people. I want to mention two people, the current one and the one just before him. After Maidan, she was there for a long time. The finance minister was Natalie Jurescu. Okay? Guess where she was born? Elmhurst, Illinois. She was totally – she's an American. You know when she became a Ukrainian citizen? 2014.
After the coup.
Could you imagine? She has nothing. She doesn't speak Ukrainian very well. She's an American. She's been American. You know what she does now? She is the executive director of the Financial Oversight and Management Board for Puerto Rico. Now, when she finally left, you had the current one, Sergei Marchenko. Now, believe it or not, he was actually born in Ukraine. But he was educated at Harvard. None of these people, have any real connection with Ukraine. At least Marchenko has more than Natalie Jurescu from Illinois. So the point of all of it is that this is what I mean when I say Ukraine is just a colony of the United States. These people have no legitimacy. They're barely Ukrainian. And the fact that they're finance ministers means that now you have a complete American takeover of every penny or, the 5 or 6 pennies that were left in Ukraine prior to the war and prior to COVID. That just gives you an example of how blatant the takeover is. There is no Ukrainian government. There's no Ukrainian independence. There's no Ukrainian ruling class. This is a colonial administration from the U.S. and to a lesser extent from Brussels.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree with you. And I think it's epitomized by this Jewish crisis actor, portraying himself as the president of Ukraine, Zelensky. He's portrayed as this darling in the Western press. But in reality, I mean, he's targeted political opposition. He's shut down media outlets. He's arrested. I forget the guy's name. He was a political opposition leader that was sort of pro-Russian. And apparently he was pretty close with Putin, where he was arrested. And, he just popped up on Zelensky's Telegram the other day, and he was praising the goons that, I guess, apparently recaptured him. I don't know exactly all the details. But this guy is a total tyrant. And yet he's portrayed as, this brave defender of democracy or something by the West. He has unwavering and just blind political and economic and military support from the West. What explains this? I mean, really, to me, it seems like the Western political and media establishment is just covering for this guy because there's been so much corruption involved in Ukraine going back to the Obama administration and probably even before that.
Well, there's no difference in the two parties. Foreign policy, even more than domestic policy, is created by corporate capital. Ask a president. The last president who knew anything about foreign affairs was Nixon, and he was condemned for that in part. Ukraine is kind of one of the things that makes Russia an empire. It could be the economic center of Eurasia. Ukraine could be in the upper reaches of the First World by now, if it had connected itself with the East, with the SCO, Shanghai Cooperation, with BRICS, the Belt and Road. But they were kept from it because Russia would then be, Russia's the seventh largest economy in the world. It would be above that at this point. The guy I just mentioned, the finance minister, the current one, Marchenko, the name of the political party he belongs to, by the way, is the Ukrainian Party of Grossman, which I don't think is a Ukrainian name. He ran with that party in the 2019 parliamentary elections, and that party got 0 seats. So none of these people, foreigners, but they're not even popular. No one's ever, there's a Navalny in Russia. No one knew who he was prior to this scandal with him. So, you know, that's what you have here. And keeping Ukraine from Russia, using it as a battering ram, is a way to keep Russia weak for a whole bunch of reasons, because the U.S., the corporate capital desperately wants those natural resources, that industry, and that market. And because you have a nationalist in office rather than one of these people, they're not letting that happen. They're still bitter about the oil field. They would have been completely taken over by now, by the West, if Putin didn't step in. He literally saved the country. So installing these people, who no one knows, who are unpopular, to do the West's bidding is a crime, especially when you consider the potential there. So there's a whole bunch of reasons for it. I mean, there's economic, there's geopolitical, there's ideological, and don't downplay the ideological, because that matters. I have the last defense strategy from the Pentagon, talks about ideology at length. Oh, by the way, I should mention that I do have a book called Ukrainian Nationalism. You know, the Ukrainian stuff has been a big deal for me since since I was in college. And I'm certainly not anti-Ukrainian. Legitimate Ukrainian nationalism has a strong role to play. This is not Ukrainian nationalism, however. This is just cosmopolitanism. And even the militia groups that are doing most of the fighting right now, when they run for office, they get barely a percentage. Not popular to them. They're considered phony.
Yeah, you know, you've talked about these militia groups a couple different times in this conversation, and I'm curious. I want to get your take on them because it frankly doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, you've explained in great detail how this entire Ukrainian regime is just totally illegitimate and corrupt. But why are these private militias doing the bidding and sort of supporting this regime? That doesn't make any sense to me. And I think, from what I can gather anyways, I think a lot of it goes back to 2014, because I don't even think Ukraine had a very well-organized military at all back then, right? And they were using some of these militias in lieu of not having an organized military. Is that right?
You're absolutely right. Even to the point now where some of these groups, again, grand total, they number no more than 5,000 people, but they are trained elsewhere. Ukraine has never had the money. The very fact that the Western world is forcing, prior to the war, Ukraine to build a navy, to build a Marine Corps, to import billions of dollars worth of weapons. This is a country that can't afford to keep its lights on for more than 20% of the night. And yet this is what the West, what Ukrainian wants to be a part of NATO when it would take billions and billions over 20 years to be able to reform that military such that it could be a part of NATO. And that's the whole reason that Yanukovych went to the customs union in the East, because the EU was demanding massive hundreds of billions in reforms and outlays in Ukraine to allow them to come into the EU. And he said, no, I'm not doing it. We don't have it anyway. And that's where the coup and the violence came from. But as far as the militias are concerned, you know, in my book, Ukrainian Nationalism, I cite them. I translate tons of stuff from them. A lot of that stuff could have been written by me. The ideology, with the exception of the anti-Russian stuff, the anti-Russian has more to do with anti-Soviet than anything else. I also go into great detail about how rotten the 18th century, how rotten the Russian Empire, run by, outsiders, was to Ukraine. But as far as the Orthodox civilization, they go very, very well together. They've assisted one another for a very long time. The Orthocephalous Church has been providing bishops for some of the traditional Russian groups. But it has to do with leadership. It has to do with money. It has to do with the fact that everyone's talking about them for the first time ever. And they claim, last I heard, leaders, I don't forget, was Azov or Brotherhood, I forget who it was, said, well, yeah, we don't like taking money from these people. We'll turn on them as soon as we're done. And they've been saying that for a long time. They have plenty of people there. Since they've been trained by NATO in the U.S., their leadership is being advised by NATO in the U.S. This is the only time they've ever had relevance. Not to mention the fact that there is no such thing as a civilian in this war. The minute Zelensky started giving out automatic weapons to anyone who showed up, not to mention a lot of these militias don't wear uniforms all the time. They're not covered by the Geneva Convention. There is no such thing. I mean, an old lady, a baby, I get it. But as far as any kind of able-bodied man or woman, they're not civilians. There's no such thing, not since Zelensky armed everyone. So that's a very complicating problem here. Anyone of combat age, whether in a uniform or not, should be considered a combatant. And like I said before, media people are also considered combatants because they most certainly are. That stuff is more powerful than any howitzer I've ever seen.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know what? We're going to be wrapping up here in just a moment. I do want to get your take on sort of like the broader geopolitical issues at play here. Because the Russians have been very clear since this conflict has started that they are done with the West. The West has been just clearly not operating in good faith, not trying to solve the conflict, not even trying to seriously consider the security concerns that they've raised. They clearly the West is trying to sabotage and subvert Russia, and the Russians are openly saying that. There was just a recent G20 meeting the other day, and you saw the US and UK officials like storm out of the meeting, demonstrating how childish and just hysterical they are, which again is sort of a major theme in how we see these Western political leaders operating. But I'm curious, what is your assessment of Russia working more closely with China and sort of uniting with these other BRICS countries to form a new international system that is free of this American-dominated system?
Well, it's almost, when I'm on the air or when I'm writing something, there isn't a paragraph that goes by without me mentioning just that. It has been a huge preoccupation of mine since at least the Obama administration, if not before. The West declared war on Russia many times in the past, surrounding them with military bases, trying to sanction them, trying to strangle the economy, which, by the way, is not what sanctions are. Sanctions are not meant to strangle civilians. But that's what they're trying to do, and they're saying it openly. Same thing for Iran. COVID hits, and then we hear about the Great Reset for the first time ever. The Great Reset is supposed to take the place of the New World Order. What's Russia's response? They invaded Ukraine and kicked the liberals out. That connection, that image, is sums up the whole story. Who gives a damn whether they're connected with the West or not? The West is disintegrating. Places like Belgium, 380% of their GDP is debt. They couldn't repay these debts if their life depended on it. There's only a few companies under BlackRock control that finance everything. The demographic collapse, the invasion from the third world, the complete crime-ridden nature of the cities. Who gives a damn? No one has any faith in the U.S. So they've created their own alternative banking system with the Chinese. Of course, the gold was a big deal. The natural resources, having a currency pegged to all that, is a big deal. Nationalizing banks, nationalizing or semi-nationalizing a lot of companies that are strategic, creating their own credit card processing system, the Mir, and just simply, and realizing that Western Europe and Central Europe are in serious trouble. Where are they getting their natural resources from? They're really struggling. I mean, these prices have gone through the roof, and it's going to get worse. And it's not just the bailouts, $2 trillion the second day of the COVID lockdown, which went to corporate America, or BlackRock, I should say. It's not just that, the lack of production, and now massive fuel prices that come from all of it. This is what's going to happen. Germany wants nothing to do with Western sanctions anymore. They have way too many investments in Russia, and they realize the future lies with the East. Not these decrepit liberal countries in the West that don't really have a large market anymore. The average household debt in America is something like $70,000. Where is this credit coming from? Credit's only going to BlackRock's people at this point. It's despite me, there's still billions of subprime loans and cards out there. So they're going to need another bailout soon enough. No one has any confidence in them. But the new economic mechanisms that Russia has created. Russia is keeping the Western companies that are a part of it a secret because it just proves that so many firms, Citibank being one, don't trust what's going to happen in the West. They need to hedge their bets, and now they're a part of Mir under state control. And I only saw this in Cyrillic a few years ago, but now you must have another group of Western corporations a part of this system, again, violating sanctions. Because they don't know the system could collapse, inflation, unemployment at any moment. No one trusts the Western economy, especially the U.S. dollar. Everything now is being done in rubles or yuan. They may even come up with a new currency to make it easy. That means China's going to be dumping dollars again.
Well, and
They just have to wait.
Putin
They just have to
was,
wait the U.S. out.
yeah. Well, and I mean, Putin just a few weeks ago was saying that the policies being implemented by these Western countries are themselves discrediting their own currency, their own political legitimacy. So it's almost like the leaders in the West are trying to speed up the destruction of their countries in a, in a misguided attempt to, to harm Russia. I mean, everything is backfiring on the West big time.
Russia just has to sit back and wait it out. When you have major corporations going to Russia for assistance, and their identity is kept a secret, you've got a problem. The U.S. dollar is being pushed out of trade with India, China, and Russia. And it will include Belarus. It includes Iran, the whole SCO. And that means the dollar's going to be dumped, and that means you're going to start seeing collapse inflation. And when you have one company, BlackRock, controlling something like 80% of Wall Street, we're not an oligarchy anymore. We're a monopoly. Half of the so-called Joe Biden administration comes from BlackRock, either one way or the other. Most of the central bankers are on the board, or they have board members who are central bankers in the Western countries. So you have one company here, and I don't care how big they are. They're leftist in, politically, by the way. They made that very clear, Jewish-owned. Some of their members are even defecting. And that's because of everything that's going on. $2 trillion a couple of years ago to bail them out. They're going to have to do it again. Where's this money coming from? So, and that's why
Good
they're using.
question.
And the military
I've been
reform.
wondering that for years. Where is the money coming from?
Inflation's much higher than is being reported. We can't get into that now because we're finishing up. But I recommend listeners go to a website called Shadow Statistics. That's a group of people from the Bureau of Labor Statistics who left. They resigned because they were being told to lie. And this is now the real inflation rate. The real, it's a pay site, but it's from professionals in the field. And oh my God.
It's probably more what, like 20%? I think officially it's like 8 or 9%. But yeah, no, it's got to be way higher than that. Yeah, no, the whole system is collapsing. I mean, as you mentioned, the cities are a mess. Crime is rampant. It's everybody's in debt. It's just untenable.
That's right.
And yeah, and Russia clearly is seeing this and calling it out, which is good. I mean, I think it's going to be tough in the West, especially in America going forward, but I think this is a positive development, frankly, because this America-led world order since World War II has been such a disaster for the entire world.
When the dollar collapses, that means liberalism collapses. American foreign investments, this is simply the liberal ideology put in dollar form. Every defeat in the U.S. military was in a disastrous state is a defeat for leftism and liberalism. That's what's happening. You don't see it as U.S., don't see it as corporate capital. You see it as liberalism taking one form or another. And it's being discredited. Worse now than ever after Ukraine. It is being humiliated, and that's a wonderful thing for us.
Right. Yeah, well said. I agree with you. Well, Dr. Johnson, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today, and we'll definitely have to do this again.
Absolutely. I appreciate your time. Again, we have to make this a more common thing.
Yes, definitely will. All right. Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. You enjoy the rest of your weekend, and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, my friend. Bye-bye.
Okay.